Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots in their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Hello, I'm Greg Fife, and welcome to our live edition of Flight Safety Detectives. It's a monthly offering. It's always good to be with my two colleagues, John Golia and Todd, the man. How are you, buddy?
Doing fine.
Good. How about you, John? You look like you're in a cave somewhere.
I am. I'm in Florida. I saw all that snow up north and decided I didn't need to go back.
Okay, well, that's good. Well, I think we got an interesting show today for our live show because we get a lot of good feedback and we greatly appreciate that. And at the end of the show, Todd will tell you about how you can provide feedback to us, good, bad, or indifferent, about the shows that we do, questions that you have. So we'll get right into it. John, one of the first questions that came up, and I'm going to let Todd really talk about the question itself, but it involves TWA 800. And we've been down this road on multiple shows. We don't get too tired of talking about it, but the conspiracy theorists still reign out there with regard to what brought that aircraft down. The facts are one thing, and as an investigative authority and the one that you and I work for, the National Transportation Safety Board, the board did a very thorough investigation of that particular event. But unfortunately, there still seems to be a faction out there that thinks that it was a nefarious act that brought that airplane down. So with that being said, Todd, why don't you get us into that question so that we'll turn it over to John today, since he spent hundreds of hours, not only himself, but his special assistant when he was a board member up at Calverton, you know, rummaging through that wreckage. I've been through it multiple times. I understand all the facts, conditions, and circumstances, but I think John fortunately has a picture that might explain it even better. So why don't you read that question for us?
Yes, this is a question from viewer Expedition Miracle. It's a fairly long question. I'll read parts of it. It's shocking, absolutely shocking to me that these two individuals can sit there with a straight face and say that TWA-800 was not shot down by a missile. Gentlemen, eventually the truth is going to come out to the general public. Those of us who know for a fact that the Navy accidentally shot down TWA-800 have tried unsuccessfully to get the proper whistleblowers from the Navy and FBI to come forward. And I'll go to the last part of his statement. It saddens me to see that you straight-faced either lie to your viewers, or worse, you are truly ignorant on what actually happened to that plane. Here's the question I see in all that. Why are you covering up the fact that the U.S. Navy missile shot down Flight 800? And by the way, side comment, I also worked on the investigation. When I was an engineer at Boeing, I was not on site, but I was engaged in it for quite a few months, as we all were, and I'm intimately familiar with the kinds of issues that we faced from the manufacturer side dealing with this. But John, you're the real expert on this.
Well, all the time I spent up there, I really was wishing that it would be a missile, right? Because I knew that this accident was going to bring about the demise of TWA. And maybe if it was a missile, it would not have had that impact. But I climbed all over that airplane with hundreds of hours looking for damage from a missile. I also brought into that facility about 1,000 people. That I'll admit to bringing 1,000 people into that facility. Inspectors, mechanics from around the world, actually, not just the U.S. And I've stood in that center fuel tank, and you can clearly see where the impact of the rapid expansion inside that tank occurred. And if the picture, Sharon, if you can put the picture up, I'd like to show you what the bottom of the tank looks like. It clearly shows the bottom is supposed to be almost perfectly flat. And if you look at it across that picture, it has a bow in it. It is blown down. The ceiling is blown up into the cabin. The forward bulkhead of the fuel tank was blown into the forward cargo compartment. The rear bulkhead was blown back. There is physical evidence in the metal that says just that. We spent hundreds and hundreds of hours, first the FBI and then the NTSB, with that metal under a scanning electron microscope. And the funny thing about metal, you can actually see where the force has come from to tear a piece of metal apart. And on all over that airplane, there are little arrows to show which direction the force that tore that airplane apart. And you can actually follow those arrows from the cockpit right back to the center fuel tank. You can carry them down from the fuselage above, and you can carry them from the rear of the airplane forward. It is clear that tank was the reason why this airplane broke apart in flight. In fact, that bow that I just mentioned, the bottom of the fuel tank, that's made out of 7075 T6 aluminum, and it's about 5/8 to 3/4 of an inch thick. It doesn't bend very easy. And the force was so severe that it actually broke the keel beam of the airplane, which is right under that fuel tank. And the reason why we know that is that keel beam was found closest to JFK Airport. It's a beam that's very similar to a beam that you would see on the highway holding up a bridge. The damn thing is thick, massive. So,
John, when we look at that kind of evidence, and again, we've talked about how a missile would impact the fuselage. That is, it doesn't actually strike the aircraft. It blows up outside with a shockwave and shrapnel. And, you know, in my examination of the fuselage and the wreckage itself, and I know you and the FBI and the rest of the team all looked for those pockmarks from shrapnel, looking for patterns and things like that. There weren't those patterns. They didn't exist. And as we've talked about on a past show, if you want to see what a missile looks like as far as damaging an aircraft, pull up the pictures of Malaysian Air MH17, not 370, but 17, because that was the one that was shot down over the Ukraine with a missile. Now, I know that this person who says they worked supposedly or was involved from Boeing's standpoint with this investigation, if they have evidence, bring it forth. We'll take a look at it. We're not above that. But I don't understand how somebody like that can say that, because when the USS Vincennes accidentally shot down an Iranian airliner years ago, you couldn't keep that secret. 1996, when this event took place, that was a political year. There's no way somebody was going to keep this secret for this long under those conditions. This information and the whistleblowers and everybody else that had physical evidence to demonstrate that this wasn't a fuel tank explosion, but some sort of nefarious act. I mean, bring the evidence forth. I mean, the NTSB has no dog in this fight with regard to covering up any kind of evidence. For what gain? It's not personal gain, and it's definitely not political gain, because the NTSB, they get a budget from Congress. They're non-regulatory authority, and you can't keep 450 people quiet, you know, for 30 years. So it's one of those things, John, where I know the story is sexy because, you know, the facts don't really, you know, build a sexy story a lot of times. But the physical evidence demonstrates that this was an inside-out explosion. That is, it originated in the tank, overpressured, because if you understand how explosions work, you have fast explosions, C4, dynamite, things like that, versus an overpressurization. And this wasn't really an explosion. This was just a structural failure due to overpressurizing that fuel tank. And you can do a simple experiment with it. Get a milk carton, plastic milk carton, fill it a little bit of gas in there, fire it up, put the top on it, and it'll overpressure until it fails. So I know that you spent hundreds of hours examining this, and with your maintenance background and then the experts you brought in, everybody agrees that it was not an external type event, nor a nefarious act.
And one last word on the conspiracy theory aspect of it, at least from the Boeing perspective, it was an all hands on deck for the safety engineering department and any other department involved in this investigation. Never, ever, ever did we get any pushback from management, from politicians, or anyone saying, don't do this or don't investigate that. So
I'm glad you brought that up, Todd, because I was going to ask you about that since you were there. There's always a lot of chatter. And I understand, you know, that some people may be very passionate about their perspective, like our viewer who wrote that comment to us. But again, the facts speak for themselves. And if you have anything that disputes those facts, then you have a moral obligation to bring it forth and let experts review it, understand it, analyze it, and see if, in fact, it has some relationship to this event. So with that being said, let's move on to another viewer question. And that regards the 605 Challenger that crashed in Bangor, Maine over a month ago in a snowstorm. And while we always talk about the fact that, you know, charter operators and owners of aircraft, there's a lot of self-induced pressure that goes along with a lot of these flights. Why? Because on a charter flight, you're trying to accomplish the mission as a business to satisfy the people that are paying for the trip. As an aircraft owner, whether it's a Cessna 172 or a 605 Challenger, you're paying pilots up in front of the airplane, in this case, quite a bit of money as professional pilots to operate that aircraft and fulfill the mission. And the question now becomes, is it really money, or, Todd, what did the viewer ask?
Well, this is a question or a statement from the viewer, Rob T. Pym, 62. Thank you for the comment. He said, hi, John and Greg. As you mentioned, this crew may have been faced with multiple pressures that likely influenced their decision-making. Another factor could have been the operation through the North Atlantic region. This region is a busy airspace requiring strict adherence to assigned slot times and routes. Any delay or deviation could have led to reslotting, which adds complexity and stress to an already challenging flight environment. Reslotting can cause fuel inefficiencies, increased workload, and disruptions in timing, which could further pressure the crew. The question I saw in that was, could the decisions to fly by the crew in the Bangor crash have been driven by a need to make the departure slot?
John, as you know, when we would go out and look at this, we go out with a very objective perspective. We don't rule anything in or out until we've got facts, conditions, and circumstances that could verify or vet a particular path that the investigative process is going to pursue. And in this case, the viewer brings up a lot of good points. It's obvious. It sounds like he or she may be a pilot who flies this particular route with the detail they provided. Yes, that kind of thing can and does influence decision-making, either as an individual pilot or as a crew. This was a business-owned aircraft. The passengers in the back, one was a partner in the law firm and the wife of the founder of the law firm itself. And the question is, why were they going to France? We know that there was some event that was taking place that they were going to attend. Whether that alone, that pressure to accomplish the mission was put on the crew, or there were other pressures, such as trying to fulfill a slot time, all of these things, I would hope the NTSB would be ferreting out and putting some validity or getting rid of it as a possible influence in this type of investigation. You've been around, John, where, you know, this has always been a question early on of, was this kind of influence taking place with airline operations as well? Because again, one of the things that we were always concerned with, like with TWA and with Air Florida taking off in lousy weather out of Washington National and things like that. The question is, did the airlines at some time in the past have that kind of status as well as, you know, pushing a crew to complete a flight?
Usually it was a crew pushing the crew. The airlines dispatch sometimes will put pressure on the crew for a commercial airline. But, you know, one point that you didn't raise, Greg, the NTSB comes to the accident with our own air traffic controllers. The NTSB employs people knowledgeable in air traffic control procedures, and we have separate people that can analyze radar data. So that whole process of getting from point A to B by a pilot, we have multiple specialties at the NTSB to look for all of those markers, if you will, that they may have disregarded in order to make a flight, including trying to maintain a slot. I worked a good portion of my career in a slot-controlled airport, and I know the pressure that slots can put on airlines and pilots and the rest of the employees. So it definitely is something that the NTSB will not overlook. You will find that in the report.
Yeah, so we'll look forward to the Safety Board's final report. Again, that'll really be the ops group and human factors group that will really pursue those issues, if you will, to determine what influenced the decision-making. It's obvious that there was a blizzard going on. It was very obvious that you had two actual airline flights by different airlines. The crews decided that they weren't going to attempt a takeoff under those conditions. And of course, that begs the question, well, if the airlines wouldn't do it, why did this crew think they could do it? What influenced their decision, good, bad, or indifferent? And that's where the learning lesson is going to be. We've talked about winter operations. We've talked about good judgment. We talk about aeronautical decision making. And I think that this type of accident could, again, unfortunately, exemplify either bad decision making or influences that lead to bad decision making. So we'll wait for the NTSB to complete its investigation, and hopefully not only will we learn some lessons, but we'll be able to at least put some information back into the industry and help pilots, especially pilots that are in training right now, understand why it's so important to factor in a lot of different information before they make a final decision, especially for operating in lousy weather, bad weather, winter operation type weather like this accident was. With that being said, Todd, you have anything to add? I know that you've been flying a lot, and you know, the weather isn't always cooperative. So what do you see from your perspective that I may have missed in my comment?
Well, I have the luxury of not having to fly for personal reasons, not for professional reasons. You know, I'm working on increasing my certification to instrument and possibly commercial rating, and I'm doing it because of my long-term interest in aviation. If the weather even looks a little bit off kilter, or if there's something wrong with the plane, I have no problem with turning right around. And yes, I know that when I make that decision, there's money involved, and it's not cheap to fly, no matter what level of flying you're at. And I know going in that, hey, the decision I might make might cost me a few dollars. If I'm not willing to lose those dollars, I'm not even going to plan the flight.
That's a good point. And again, you know, the question about money influencing decision making should be asked and answered, hopefully, by the NTSB investigation. With that being said, let's transition to the media. You know, we have all been in front of a TV camera. We've been on social media talking about various events and safety issues that have cropped up, especially in the last year with the multiple accidents that we've had. And of course, there's always the concern that not only the officials that provide information, such as from the NTSB, the FAA, or even the Secretary of Transportation's office, with regard to not only aviation, but all things transportation, if you will, whether or not the comments are being influenced. We got a comment slash question from a viewer who asked Todd.
Well, this is the viewer, the Urantia 001. Thank you for the comment. The question has to be seriously considered. How is any critical thinking person expected to trust any data from these regulators when final reports are released? We all know these conglomerates will negotiate the narrative to keep their reputations intact and minimize losses. They can afford the world-class lawyers who know people who know people who know people. The public are not privy to the insider proprietary info and do not have world-class lawyers at their beck and call. The question I saw in that, by the way, the last two comments I think are true. The public isn't privy to insider proprietary information because it's proprietary, not for public discussion. And can you afford a world-class lawyer? Only if you have world-class money, and most people don't. That said, the question I see in that is, given the power of big corporations, can we trust any findings or decisions of the NTSB?
Actually, you know what? I had that question come from the accident, Greg, that you did, and I ended up being the hearing officer for ValueJet. And actually, some of the family members way after the end of it, penned a letter to me saying that they went into the final hearing expecting a whitewash, expecting ValueJet, the airline at that time, to escape all scrutiny, and that didn't happen. As you know, Greg, I went off in one of my tangents, and I held them responsible, and we actually changed the report. The board changed the report to accurately reflect the role that the airline itself played in that accident, and a benign neglect to a lot of operating issues. So, I can take it one step further. At one point on another accident, I had received a phone call from the committee, the Senate Commerce Committee oversees the NTSB. And at that time, the chairman of that committee was John McCain. I had a contentious accident, and he called me and wanted to know if I was getting any pressure from the White House or from anywhere else that would influence my handling of that event. And I told him I did not. And he said, if you do, I want you to call me immediately, and gave me his personal cell phone number. And yeah. That's the triad that the NTSB operates under. The White House watches what the NTSB does. Congress watches what the NTSB does. And Congress and the NTSB themselves, the chairman, pays close attention to what the NTSB is doing. So that three-legged stool is a very delicate balance, and it works.
And when you look at it from that perspective, John, again, the NTSB is a non-regulatory agency. They are the neutral party, if you will, because they have oversight responsibility of all the alphabet groups, the DOT, the FAA, the FRA, and it goes on and on in across the transportation corridor. And so for the NTSB, when you have the chairman or yourself as a board member producing information and providing statements with that information, the NTSB doesn't have a dog in the fight. They don't do things for litigants. They don't do things to assign liability. That's a court of law. What the board is trying to do is identify the facts, conditions, and circumstances, identify causal and contributing factors for the enhancement of aviation safety through those findings. That's what forms the basis for safety recommendations. And so when you look at whether it's, Chairman Hamady providing information about the recent midair collision, or Todd Inman talking about UPS, you can take that information to the bank because it's been vetted. It's factual information. What the purpose of the board is at the very end is to take all those factual findings and put logic to them to build the storyline as to what caused and contributed to the accident. The information is, you know, that is released, even through a public hearing like you and I have been through multiple times, it's a fact-finding part of the process. And like you said, if there is any kind of influence, you know, the Congress wants to know about it. Now, with regard to the party system, and a lot of people don't understand the party system, and we've explained that as well. We need, and I talk about we because, you know, I used to be at the NTSB as well as you. The fact is that the NTSB cannot be a subject matter expert in all areas. That is, they don't know everything there is to know about a Boeing or an Airbus or an Embraer airplane. They don't know everything there is to know about a GE or a Pratt engine. So they bring in parties, subject matter experts that can be basically advisors to them, provide technical expertise. There is a challenge and response. There is a vetting of the information. And we've seen it in the past. And John, I think you've been part of that. Where
on both sides.
Exactly. And so it doesn't behoove a manufacturer or a designated party to an NTSB investigation to withhold information. It's clearly presented by the investigator in charge in the organizational meeting that a company will not withhold information. We were concerned with ValueJet doing that. We were concerned with others in that particular investigation withholding information to include the FAA. And John, you and I were responsible for seven people losing their position at the FAA during ValueJet for that very reason. The board has, again, no dog in the fight. They're looking to uncover all the facts, conditions, and circumstances. They don't care where the axe falls. They want to know that that it's been done and done thoroughly. So I know that you've been through that process, John, and I'll give you just a few seconds because we're running out of time with our show. But again, it doesn't behoove anybody that's designated as a party to withhold information.
Or play with information. We have a major U.S. airline who had control of the flight data recorder for a runway overrun issue, and it was routed back through their main base. They decided to download the flight data recorder before they sent it to Washington. And I can tell you, for those individuals that were involved in that, it wasn't a career enhancement move. And we have another one with some engineers at another airline. We're hiding records, maintenance records, and that wasn't a good move for them either. So
yeah,
it's going to come out. I don't care who you are, it's going to come out.
Yeah. And I have a personal aside to add to this. As a party to several investigations when I was at Boeing, I recall distinctly before I really started as an engineer there that we were sat down for training. How do you write things in your engineering notes and whatnot that won't expose the company to liability? I paid attention to those lessons. When it came to investigations, those lessons were set aside. It's like, whatever you folks wanted, we gave it to you. We had obscure stuff from all corners of the Boeing universe, and if that was relevant to what was happening in the investigation, we had no problem with, I had no problem, you know, bringing that forward and giving it to you. And it's kind of hard to explain, you know, the world of corporate power and how it influences people, which is why I came up with, I found a couple of graphics, actually political cartoons, that sort of illustrate what the dance is that literally is being done between the government, private corporations, regulators, the courts of justice. Money is a big player. Some people can be influenced by money. Some people can't. The folks you see on the screen right now, they had their chances. They took them. They didn't succeed.
Yeah, and those are very worthwhile comments because that's unfortunately the perception out there. But the reality is, especially at the NTSB, it would be very difficult to try and hide something like that, given the fact that, one, the board is really very a very transparent agency. Two, the board is constantly turning over, depending on administrations and that kind of thing. And then three, they're constantly having to justify their existence up on Capitol Hill. And, you know, everybody is digging for the dirt. And the fortunate thing is the board doesn't have a lot of background dirt as to any kind of influence. So, and the board is made up, and John, you know this very well, the board is made up of, you know, various parties. It's not a controlling party. It's not all Republican. It's not all Democrat. It's not all independent, for a very good reason, and that is to dissuade or at least mitigate the possibility of any kind of political influence.
How true. How true.
So with that being said, gentlemen, I think that this was a good show to at least identify and try and get through some of the questions that that have been asked. Hopefully we've provided a lot of answers. We want to thank our sponsor, or one of our primary sponsors, and that is Avemco Insurance. They always do a great job for us in the show, but they also do a great job for me because I do have Avemco Insurance for my aircraft and as a flight instructor and a renter pilot. They also provide me those insurances as well. So if you're looking for a 5% discount, definitely contact Avemco. Tell them you watch Flight Safety Detectives. And again, Avemco has been a great sponsor for us, and we want to continually improve this show. So with that being said, Todd, I'm going to leave you with our second to the last word so that we can get to the patriarch of the organization.
Well, my second to the last word is, keep those questions coming. We like those questions. These questions help us focus what we're saying about aviation safety. And if you have questions for us, please email them to us at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. It doesn't matter what the question is. Even if you use language that's not fit for public consumption, we will read your emails.
John, we're going to transition.
Before we move on, I have to also add that we would like you to subscribe to the channel. And those of you who are looking at the video here, you can see in the corner, you can click on that subscribe button. You can click on that like button. Why? Because that enhances our algorithmic prowess within YouTube. Leave us a comment or share what you've seen today with your friends, family, and colleagues.
Absolutely. Well, with that, John, we will leave you. The last word for us.
Okay, so as usual, if you're going to go flying, please plan your trip well before you even get to the airport. After you get to the airport, do it all over again. If it doesn't agree, find out why. You get out to your airplane, do a good pre-flight, including the fuel. I had a listener criticize me because I recommended full fuel tanks. And the reason why I'm saying that to a lot of us pilots, a lot of student pilots listen to us, is that I'm sick and tired of looking through accidents for airplanes that run out of fuel. And I tell you, I'd like to go back and look at them all and look how many a year we have. But I bet I touched over 500 airplane accidents that have run out of fuel in the recent past. I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy. Yes, we should manage the fuel. Yes, it makes more common sense to fill it up, not fill the tank up, but fill up what you need. But it's failing us. It's failing too many pilots. So maybe we need to tell them just fill up the tanks. And I know that's difficult on some airplanes that take 100 gallons. Once you fill it up once, if you're only using 20, you know, that's the end of it. So now we're running out of time, so I'll just say, if you're going to go flying, please pay attention, put your head on a swivel, and please fly safely.
And if you're looking to sponsor a segment or the show itself, you can do it, because as you see on the screen, you can have your logo presented during the course of our show. So we're always looking for sponsorships. Please, if you want to sponsor the show, sponsor what we're trying to do, take the show forward. You see the email. It is flightsafetydetectivesponsors@gmail.com. We would love to have you as a sponsor and definitely present your logo on the show. So with all of that, gentlemen, I really appreciate getting together with you. I love these live shows that we do once a month, and I'll be looking forward to seeing you again, not only on our regular show, but of course on our live show next month. Fly safe.
Thank you.